This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon has made a lot of people laugh. He started his career in the early days of television, writing for Sid Caesar's Show, Phil Silver's Sergeant Bilko, and The Gary Moore Show. But his real ambition was to write plays, and he lit up Broadway with a string of hits, including Come Blow Your Horn, Barefoot in the Park, Plaza Suite, Prisoner of Second Avenue, The Sunshine Boys, The Goodbye Girl, California Suite, Brighton Beach Memoirs, Biloxi Blues, and Laughter on the 23rd Floor. He also wrote the book for the musical Sweet Charity and Promises, Promises. Simon adapted many of his plays into successful films. The Odd Couple became a popular movie and TV series, and his stage hit The Goodbye Girl is now in its second film incarnation, this one a made-for-TV movie starring Jeff Daniels and Patricia Heaton. It premieres this weekend on the cable channel TNT. Here's a clip from the 1977 film adaptation of The Goodbye Girl, starring Richard Dreyfuss and Marsha Mason. Dreyfuss plays an actor who's arrived in New York thinking he's sublet an apartment. When he arrives, he's surprised to find it's occupied by Mason and her daughter.
So what's the deal, huh? I mean, I got a lease here in my pocket. You gonna honor it or what?
I got a daughter in my bed. That tops a lease in your pocket.
Look, I don't want to get legal. You know, legal happens to be on my side. Now, I happen to have a lawyer acquaintance downtown. Now, all I gotta do is call this lawyer acquaintance of mine.
Oh,
whoa, what?
An actor. Another damn actor. I happen to have a lawyer acquaintance. Write out a streetcar named Desire. Stanley Kowalski in summer stock, right?
Wrong. Chicago in the dead of winter. 3.5 months at the Drury Lane Theater.
Ask an actor a question, he gives you his credits.
You want to hear the reviews? Elliot Garfield brings to Kowalski dimensions that even Brando had not investigated.
Terrific! You write beautifully. Aren't you a little short to play Stanley?
Nobody noticed. I stood on the poker table. What are you, a critic?
Terry Gross spoke to Neil Simon in 1996 after he'd published his memoir titled Rewrites. She asked how he developed his ear for writing dialogue.
I never thought about it much, but the only thing that came to me is that when I was a young boy, 5 and 6 and 7 years old, my parents would take me to visit their relatives, and for some reason, I think they thought that I was invisible because they never talked to me.
Right, or they talk about you even though you could hear?
I could hear, but they were talking family matters or gossip or whatever, and I just sat there, and once in a while, they'd give me a cookie or something. And I just listened. I wasn't terribly interested, but it stuck in my head. And what I managed to learn was the way they talked, the choice of words they made, what it was that they were interested in. And years later, without knowing it, when I started to write about these people, I was able to draw on my own memory from what happened in those days.
Early on in your career, your brother Danny was your writing partner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's what? About 8 years older?
Eight and a half years old, yes.
Yeah. And you write in your book that he was somewhere between your brother and your father. He was your mentor as well as your
mm-hmm.
brother. And your father actually was in and out of the family. He left the family and came back, I think, about 8 times.
Exactly, yes.
Was it strange to have him coming and going like that, not knowing exactly what his relationship to you was?
It was awful because I felt my life was sort of on a yo-yo, to give my kind of example. My mother never knew when he was coming back, and the whole world lit up when he came back because it meant not only did we not have to fear for the rent because he didn't leave any money for us, we didn't have to worry about food, but I felt a solidity there with the family, and I felt happy for my mother. When he was gone, it was the most awful time, and I thought he was never coming back. And I'm sure a lot of my personality has been formed by that relationship, and it makes me somewhat insecure at times, and it's why I think I fell back on writing, possibly, as a way of being able to support and survive for myself.
I imagine your mother, when your father was gone, ended up very busy with earning money to take care of the family. And
yes, she was uneducated.
Mm-hmm.
She did not have a job, and she would do whatever she could to provide for us. She borrowed from her family, but what she eventually did, which was the hardest thing for us, was but she took in two men to live in our house, two boarders, who took her bedroom, and she slept on the sofa in the living room. My brother and I had our own bedroom. And they were butchers, and they paid us mostly in meat and lamb chops.
Gee.
It was And it was no fun sitting at the room in the kitchen eating with them.
Why not?
They were like strangers. They didn't talk to us. They were mostly foreigners. And I don't mean mostly foreigners. They were foreign and spoke some English. But it was difficult, and it was not my father. And I felt I was living in not my house, but their house.
You know, the stereotype of the Jewish mother of your mother's generation was of the overly possessive, overly neurotic Jewish mother, right? I imagine your mother was much too busy.
She was.
To fit that stereotype at all.
No, I don't think she did fit that stereotype. She was very different. She was very loving and very encouraging in terms of my brother and I doing the writing. My brother, foolishly, I think, would read the monologues that we would write at first to my mother, and she would just laugh all the way through. And my brother said, "Do you understand what they mean?" And she said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Well, why are you laughing?" She says, "Well, it pleases me to please you." I mean, it was such a wonderful thing for her to do. It didn't encourage us as writers, but it encouraged us that we had a terrific mother.
You write that your brother got you a whore shortly after your 21st birthday, and that was your sexual initiation.
Yes, it was.
Looking back, was that a good way to become initiated?
I don't know if it was a good way. It was the only way. I mean, if he left it to me, I'd be 54 before it happened. I'm sure glad it did happen. But it did change me. I mean, you have to get through that moment. Because it was the most fearful moment of my life, and I don't know why it is, looking back. I mean, that you don't expect this woman to think that you should be expert at what you're doing or that this is going to be a very personal affair and that we should like each other. It's really a cash-and-carry business, and you just do it. But I felt so much better having done it and that I would never have to do it that way again, which I never did.
There's a similar but different scene in Biloxi Blues where the character there also has his first experience with a prostitute, but that's on an army base, so it's...
Yeah, but the origin of that scene in that film was exactly what happened to me. I mean, it was with a prostitute.
Yeah.
It was his fellow friends bringing him there, but there was a line in it that summed it up, because I felt the same way when it happened to me. He said, I'm not expecting this to be a pleasurable experience. I just want to get through it.
Neil Simon speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. Here's that scene they were talking about from the 1988 film Biloxi Blues.
A half an hour he's been in there. If he doesn't hurry up, I'm going to pass my peak.
Hey, what if she's ugly? I mean, really ugly.
Then you close your eyes and you think of some cheerleader.
I don't want to close my eyes. That's the same as doing it to yourself.
Not if you're feeling someone underneath you or on top of you.
On top of me? Would be on top of me.
She would. She could be anywhere. Under a table, on a chair, or an ironing board.
On an ironing board? What kind of a girl is this? I thought we were going to a regular place.
Don't you know anything?
Maybe not an actual experience. I have all the information I need.
Do you know how many positions there are?
American or worldwide? This guy is a riot.
We'll hear more from Neil Simon after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1996 interview with playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon.
What was Broadway like when you first got there?
It was great. There were, I would say, a minimum of 20 plays on Broadway. I think today you'd be lucky to find 5 plays on Broadway. When I say a minimum, I think maybe there'd be 30. And if you would count the amount of plays that were there during the entire season, the plays that failed and moved on or had run its run from the year before. So there could be 40 plays on Broadway. Actors were always acting. Once a play closed, they auditioned for another play. And so it was not a place that I felt I was not going to be able to break into. There was a long road to do it because I had to write a play and get it past the producers. I showed the first play, Come Blow Your Horn, to many producers, about 10 or 12 of the best of them, David Merrick and Garson Kanin and some of the best-known people in the theater. They gave me wonderful tips about writing the plays, but they didn't want to put on a Come Blow Your Horn. They didn't think it was experienced enough, and so the only way I could save it was by going to summer stock to the Bucks County Playhouse in New Hope, Pennsylvania. We put it on there. It was sort of a success, but it wasn't there all the way through, and so the producers there said if I took 6 months and rewrote it and they liked the rewrite, they would put it on Broadway. But it was a glorious time on Broadway then, and I'm sorry to see it not the same way.
What's changed? What was once there that you miss now?
The accessibility of seeing the best actors in the business. There was Henry Fonda and any other number of wonderful actors who would come from Hollywood each year to do it. When the difference in salaries didn't seem to mean anything, but now an actor in one television series could make enough in that one series, if it ran 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, to last him his life. He never had to work again. We've lost all of those actors, lost them from the theater. Very hard to get somebody who would come back and do a play. You do occasionally, but it's few and far between.
Let me ask you about creating two of your most famous characters, Felix and Oscar, the odd couple.
Yes.
How did you come up with those characters?
Well, I just watched it in real life. It was my brother, Danny, and a friend of his named Roy Gerber, both of whom moved in together in the same apartment because they recently were divorced. And they wanted to cut down on their expenses so they could help pay their alimony. And in their social life, rather than going out on a double date somewhere and spending a lot of money on the dinner, my brother Danny decided to cook. And Roy was kind of a, you know, things came and go very easily for him. So he would just say to the girls, come out for dinner, come, you know, 6:30, 7, 7:30, whenever you're ready. Well, to Danny, that was anathema. I mean, he cooked the pot roast that night. He wanted them there at 7:30. And I watched this one night. I came up to Danny's apartment and Roy's apartment. I saw this taking place as they were getting prepared for this dinner. I was going to leave before the dinner happened. And it was hilarious to me. And I said, Danny, this is a great movie, a great play, something. You must write it, because Danny was a writer too. But he never wrote by himself. And he started to write the play, but he took 3 months or so to write 10 pages and finally called me and he said, I can't do it. He says, I'm not a writer and I'm certainly not a playwright. He is a writer, of course, but he was not a playwright and he didn't know how to construct it. And he said, you take the play and you do it. And so I made a financial arrangement with him because it was his basic, it wasn't his idea to do it as a play, but it was his life, so I was taking a part of it. When I wrote the play in the beginning, I thought I was writing a very dark comedy. I didn't think it was going to be as funny as it was dark, because here was a man who was broken up with his wife that he loved dearly, and he had to leave his two children at home, and he was almost suicidal. Whereas Roy was another kind of character who was, I mean, the character that Roy was based on, the Oscar character, was a man who couldn't really keep his life going together, didn't know how to take care of his children's goldfish when they left. And so I thought I was writing, as I said, this grim comedy until I gave it to Bob Fosse, a good friend of mine who lived in the same building, to read. And he says, this is the funniest play I've ever read. And I said, you don't find it dark? And he said, no, not at all. So the author is not always sure about what impression he's going to leave when he writes this thing.
Now, how'd you feel about The Odd Couple when it became a TV series, where instead of like a constructed play every week, there was another little adventure or mishap to write
well,
around?
Well, I have to preface that by telling you the story, which you may have read in the book, that I had a business agent who thought he was doing me a favor by getting a deal made with Paramount Pictures, whereby they would buy this little company from me for $125,000, which seemed like an enormous amount of money, in which they got all of the TV and television rights to The Odd Couple. So I never saw a penny of any of The Odd Couple television series. So I could not watch that. I didn't watch that for 2 years, because when I saw that it was a hit, I saw that's my money going down their drain.
Right.
And I also lost all of the stage rights of Barefoot in the Park. Never made a penny on that play from the day it opened. And so so I looked at that as a very bad experience, and it was hard for me to watch the show until I finally did see it about 2 years after it was running, and I saw how good it was. It was really good. Didn't do me any good, but it's okay for them.
Oh, boy, what heartburn it must cost to feel that you almost don't want to see the success of your own work because you're not getting anything out of it.
I know. It was hard, but maybe just pushed me on to do other things. And I said, I've got to get on with this. I'm not going to sit and just gripe about it for the rest of my life. And I just went on to write other plays.
You write a little bit in your book about being in analysis. And you say that your first year of analysis was, in a sense, an attempt to introduce you to yourself, the two sides of you, one the writer and the other the person who doesn't write, are these two sides of you at odds?
Well, they have been for years. They weren't always at odds. They were just different people. They were not the person that I was with my family, with my friends. The writer is a very solitary person who is, I guess in the worst sense, willing to pick the bones of somebody else's character and put it up there on the stage, even though I don't think I've ever hurt anybody by doing it, because no one ever came up to me and said, how dare you put this up there on the stage. As a matter of fact, when I put my father up on the stage and Come Blow Your Horn, he came to see it, and I was very fearful of what he was going to say. And I said, what'd you think, Dad? And he says, oh, I know men just like that. He never saw himself in it at all, which is what most people do. Sometimes they people come up to me and they say, that was me you were writing about, wasn't it? And it wasn't at all anything that I was writing about. So about the two Neil Simons, yes. The writer was persistent. He just always wanted to write. The other person wanted to have more fun, more leisure time, more time with his family. And so they were at odds. But I find as time goes on, right about now, maybe as we're talking, that the two characters are becoming more wed to each other. I don't see the disparity in the two personalities anymore. It sounds like I'm a little psychotic, but I'm not really.
Well, maybe that's because the two have lived together for so long. They've become more acclimated to each other.
I know. I'm my own odd couple.
That's a nice way of looking at it. Did analysis help?
Well, analysis, I think, helps in the long run. I never went for, like, long, long periods at a time. I would go from time to time when there was great trouble in my life, when my first wife died, when I had other personal problems. But after a while, I started to go because it was a way of learning about myself and about learning about other people, because the conversations were not only about this Neil Simon character. It was about how they are affected by other people in the world. And once you get into that subject, you start to talk about the other people in the world, and you realize that you do not live alone in this world. So it was very educational for me. I graduated, got a diploma. It was very nice.
Was it helpful for you as a writer to introspect out loud like that?
I think so. The one thing it helped me to do was open myself up to a complete stranger, because I went to different analyst during my life, and I never had any trouble doing it. I know people who would say, oh, I would never tell that to my analyst. And I said, what are you going for? I was never afraid that they were going to betray my privacy or that they were going to dig too deep. I was sometimes afraid that I was going to go someplace that was so dark and deep in myself that it might throw me. But it never did. I never found that place that was so awful. I just realized that I was human and I was subject to human experiences and troubles and travails and a lot of happiness. If anything, the analysts may have taught me to try to enjoy my life so much. One of them said, Neil, you don't enjoy your successes long enough. And I said, well, how you mean to play? And she says, yes. I mean, you go around for about 3 or 4 days and say, this is great. And then you just go back to work and you forget about it. And I said, well, you have to tell me how long I'm supposed to enjoy myself. it's work to me, and I enjoy the work, so I'm enjoying the work more than I am the success.
You also had claustrophobia, right?
I did, yes. Strangely, it just went away. I don't know. I couldn't get on planes. I couldn't get on elevators. And
Didn't you live in an apartment building? Didn't you live in an apartment, like a high-rise?
In New York?
Yeah.
Yes, but not while I had claustrophobia. I mean,
yeah, otherwise
I was growing
you'd be taking the stairs a lot.
Yes, when I was growing up in New York, we lived on the third floor, so I walked up there. When I did live in a building that had an elevator, if it had an elevator, man, then I was all right. Once the push buttons came in, I was getting kind of scared. But it just disappeared one day. I couldn't get on a plane without a drink or something like that, or a pill. That went away as well. I sometimes can get it. I don't like driving in a car where I have to, that's a two-door car, and I have to sit in the back. And that it all has to do with control. It means I am at the whim of the person driving the car. If I say, stop the car, I want to get out, and he says, no, I'm stuck back there. So I need control over my life, which is why I think one of the reasons I became a writer, because while I'm in that room, nobody can say, no, that's not good, you can't do that.
Well, Neil Simon, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Playwright and screenwriter Neil Simon speaking with Terry Gross in 1996. His play, The Goodbye Girl, has been adapted to film for a second time. This one is a made-for-TV movie starring Jeff Daniels and Patricia Heaton, which airs this weekend on TNT.